Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel for this Wednesday, the 9th of October. It is so nice to have you here. Big hand to both David and Sarah for the incredible work that they did. Thank you, Bob. The great work that they did this morning, and to everyone who gave and got into the lockbox. We so appreciate it, and we really are we're on the move, and that's a good place to be at this point. All right. Let me introduce everybody to you. We have, I think, a very important discussion this morning. It's a roundtable panel, and we're going to be talking about our current events of the day and the news of the day, but we are going to begin with the massive Hurricane Milton that is expected to hit Florida's west coast late today, early tomorrow morning. According to the Washington Post, hurricane season appears to have awoken all at once. In less than 2 weeks, two major hurricanes formed in the Gulf of Mexico with ferocious strength. First, the massive Hurricane Helene brought torrential deadly rains hundreds of miles away from where it initially hit land. Now, Hurricane Milton is swirling toward the Florida coast after catapulting from a tropical storm to a Category 5 hurricane. In about a day, it is expected to hit as a Category 4. It ranks as the fifth most intense on record. Hurricanes require a lengthy recipe list to materialize, but scientists agree that one ingredient has been pushing these storms to new limits recently, and that is ocean heat. So, to discuss, we have a very special guest panelist with us this morning. He's a dear friend of this program and has been with us for a very long time. Best-selling author Jeff Goodell is here. Jeff's latest book is The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. He has covered climate change for more than two decades at Rolling Stone, The New York Magazine, and many other publications. As a commentator on climate and energy issues, he's appeared on NPR, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, and right here at Mighty WAMC. He joins us this morning from Asheville, North Carolina, where he was reporting on the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. Jeff Goodell, good morning. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Joe. It's great to be with you again.
Always wonderful to have you on the program, and thank you very much for taking time out to be with us. I greatly appreciate it. Let me introduce the rest of our gang this morning, our wonderful panelists who are with us. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good, Joe. It's a lovely fall day here, but if I could just make a pitch to everybody, now's the time to be thinking forward. You know, look at what you've got at home. Check your flashlights. Think about the safety equipment that you have and be prepared. That's going to be the theme today.
If you've never heard Bob before during the storm broadcast, Bob is Mr. Tuna. So, how many cans?
Yes, you should have enough for 72 hours to
okay,
take care of
there
yourself.
You go. All right.
Depending on how much you eat.
That's a lot of tuna.
That's a lot of tuna. Anna Markowitz joins us, an advanced lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan. Anna, good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you here on this Wednesday morning. Mark Whitman is a Wall Street investment banker and regular panelist to this program. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Morning, Joe. Happy to be here, even on a fun drive day. I think it's important, and I'm happy to help out.
Thank you very much. And we really look forward to you all helping out, and we'll be going over to some pitch breaks a little bit later on. And thank you for helping out in any possible way that you can. So Hurricane Milton is ready to strike later today, and I want to talk about that. First, Jeff, give us a sense of, you're in Asheville, when you arrived, what you're seeing, and kind of what you are experiencing at the moment.
Well, Joe, I just arrived yesterday, so I'm still kind of getting oriented. But what I'm seeing here is, you know, the kind of dramatic devastation that I've seen in the aftermath of other hurricanes and tropical storms, and mixed with places where life is going on as usual. It's a very strange combination. But, you know, the drama of what's happened here is kind of at once pervasive and sort of startlingly obvious. Yesterday, I walked through the Arts District down on the French Broad River, which is sort of the kind of cultural hub of Asheville. And, you know, it was just a giant pile of rubble. And there were people there picking through things and trying to save what they can, people rolling out. You know, I saw one shop owner rolling out a bunch of hangers full of filthy, muddy clothes. You know, I walked by a telephone pole that was wrapped, you know, 60 feet high with wood pallets and twisted roofs and houses that have been moved off their moorings and kind of jumbled into other houses. You know, it's a beautiful morning here. It's very strange, this feeling of this sort of, it's a fall day. It's really lovely, and yet there's sirens going off all around me right now. I'm about to head off into the mountains to look at some of the smaller towns that have been really devastated. I drove by the hospital a few minutes ago. The emergency services area was crowded with activity. So it's really, you know, it's been a week and it's still a big mess.
How much of the foreboding, if you will, or just the psychological cloud that is over the whole situation that another storm is bearing down on the southern part of the country?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that that's not so much part of the consciousness here, because I think people are so, you know, focused on trying to get the city and the state back up and running. But I think for people like me and you and for a lot of our listeners, it's a very big deal. And for me, you know, I've been covering climate change for 20 or 25 years, a very long time. And I've covered and been part of a number of hurricanes, and starting with Hurricane Sandy back in New York. And even for me, you know, the fact that we had these two back-to-back hurricanes hitting in the same place, you know, within weeks of each other is to me kind of really emblematic of something that climate scientists and climate activists and people who've been watching this for a long time have been talking about, which is the amplification and acceleration of the impacts that we're seeing, that as our climate gets hotter and hotter, we are going to see these cascading impacts. We're going to see bigger, stronger, more destructive storms. We're going to see more extreme heat waves. We're going to see more extreme rainfall events like the ones that we had in Vermont last year that were so devastating. I mean, this is what climate change means as it accelerates. And it's, to me, what makes it kind of so terrifying and so urgent.
Are we talking about the right things right now? I mean, I know it seems to be, especially where you are in North Carolina, the question is government response and getting things back together. And I know you're early into it, but where we are in that. But also, just then when we start saying, okay, we have this other storm coming, but at what point do we start thinking, okay, we have to change what we're doing to make this situation, to try to pull the plug on this situation from happening in the future?
Well, you know, I mean, we're certainly thinking about the right things in some ways, right? There's been a big effort to cut emissions. The price of renewable energy has fallen dramatically in the last decade. There's more and more emphasis on adaptation and preparation for these extreme events. But the problem is that sort of Mother Nature is outpacing our efforts very dramatically. And these extreme events are happening faster and faster. And it's very clear that, you know, our world is built for a climate that no longer exists. And I think that's really important to understand, and the profundity of that, of thinking about that, that the climate that we live in now and that we're going to continue to live in is not the climate that our world was built to deal with. And that implies everything from where we built real estate on the coast, the kinds of building codes we have, the kind of stormwater drainage systems we have, on and on to things like the spread of diseases is very different as temperatures rise, how we protect ourselves from heat waves. So on one level, we're getting it, and there's a lot of progress. On another level, we haven't even come close to really grasping the scope and scale of the changes that are ahead of us.
Bob?
No, I'm in complete agreement. I think one thing that we're not spending a lot of time talking about, and we should, is things like in 2004, I actually responded down with a team from Virginia to help with in Punta Gorda in Hillsborough for Storm Charlie that came in and was supposed to hit Tampa, went further south. It was the first time in, I think it was like 75 years, though, that they had a hit on the west side of Florida. And we're starting to see this on a regular basis, Joe. I mean, one of the questions that was before the panel started that Dave and Sarah were talking about was what are real life examples of climate change? And I think what's going on in the Gulf and the power of the hurricanes that are coming up the Gulf, the power of the marine heat wave and what it's doing to turbocharge these storms, it is going to make areas that are very desirable to live in fundamentally unsafe to live in. I hope today we can talk about things like what is the expectation of government response and bailout in areas that we know are no longer livable. What should be the posture of our response community. I would like to talk a little bit about where FEMA should be in the pantheon of agencies, and how do we address something that I think was key in the earlier statements, is that we need to stop thinking that this is a temporary blip. We need to start to think about that this is the new normal, and how do we live with that.
Right, Anna.
I mean, I completely agree. I grew up across the street from a beach and with a marsh in my backyard. And during Sandy, a lot of my neighbors' houses flooded. And it's kind of part of the reason why I live in the mountains now. And this North Carolina hurricane really, I think, startled me in a way that other hurricanes haven't, because it made me think, oh, this isn't just a coastal problem. This is everywhere. This is, climate change is really changing what we know about storms. It's meaning that places that weren't hit before can be, and it can, the flood risk can be almost as much as the wind risk. And so I think we really need to use this as a wake-up call to expedite all of our climate efforts. Now's the time.
Mark?
Joe, if you look at this problem not only domestically but internationally, and I'm interested what Jeff thinks about this, but I think it's pretty well decided amongst the most sober that the world is not going to meet its goals of constraining carbon emissions to the point where we're going to constrain global warming at 1.5 degrees centigrade. And I think it's time that the U.S. and the world admit that, which is not to say that we need to reduce our efforts at decreasing what we omit or even mitigating what we have omitted. But more importantly, in the short run, there are lots of things that we can do in this country and we can do internationally to start to protect people against the effects of the consequences of these storms and severe weather events. And frankly, it's time we admit that we're going to turn our homework in late and get on with protecting people from the consequences of that and reset our goals as to what we can do with restraining emissions and decide what the more realistic approach is to that problem as well.
Jeff, that's a great point. Let me ask you what you make of that, of resetting our goals. And first of all, do you agree with that? And second of all, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I've believed since, in fact, I wrote about it since in the Paris, at the Paris Agreement in 2015, when the 1.5C goal was first sort of proposed and announced, you know, that we may as well, you know, commit to, you know, writing to work on unicorns too. I mean, it was, to my mind, never really going to happen. And it's pretty clear now, I think, among the sober-minded, that it's not going to happen. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to continue to work really hard to stop, to cut emissions, because, you know, I think one of the things that people don't grasp is that, you know, all this stuff is the climate impacts that we're talking about are going to continue to get worse as long as we continue to emit emissions. And then once we get to this sort of mythical net zero, which we may, or, you know, there's an aspiration to reach by 2050, that is not going to restore the old climate back to the one that we all grew up in. All that is going to do is sort of stop the warming. So we are, you know, we have permanently created a new climate that is more extreme. And I would push back a little bit on the phrase the new normal. I think, you know, I think it's more like the new abnormal. I mean, the rules are different. The jet stream is wiggling in different ways. We don't know how fast the glaciers in West Antarctica are going to collapse. We don't know what's happening to the ocean conveyor belt in the Atlantic, which controls a lot of the weather in the Northern Hemisphere. There's a lot of uncertainties in how this is going to react. And so when we think about how we're going to prepare for this, you know, the question is, what are we preparing for? And that makes it all the more urgent and all the more important that we really think seriously about, you know, changing how we build our world and how we think about things like emergency preparedness and all the other things to make our lives more resilient and more rugged.
When, go ahead, Bob.
You know, and Joe, we have to be prepared as a society that there's a cost associated with that. Take something like the building codes. We can build much more resilient communities. They are going to cost more money. They may not be as aesthetically pleasing. We may have to limit where we build. The idea of living on a beach, you know, I think about the pictures down in Hatteras, North Carolina, of the houses, you know, basically falling into the ocean. When we see the damage, the potential damage that we could see from Milton, that is, I think, potential to be absolutely catastrophic. It's going to cost more. Our critical infrastructure is going to have to be completely reworked. Something as simple as the ability to handle water runoff right now. On a regular day, on a regular rainstorm, Miami floods because of the size of their stormwater systems aren't enough to handle. It's certainly not going to be enough to handle the new patterns are doing to us. So all of this points towards a fundamental change in how we think about our built environment, and honestly, making some hard decisions about where we build. And at some point in time, as a taxpayer, I need to push back and say I appreciate the fact that you've got money and you want to live on the water and look out over the beautiful ocean. I'm not going to pay for that. And I'd be interested in some part of the discussion going to the idea of what's going to happen when the insurance pulls out of places like Florida and the coastal communities, because all of these things are going to have an enormous impact on our built environment, where we live, our communities, and our economy.
Let's pause the conversation. We will continue when we come back. We welcome all of you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Jeff Goodall is our guest. We also welcome Bob Griffin, Anna Markowitz, and Mark Whitman. Thank you very much. We'll be right back after this check-in with Pledge Central.
1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. We are trying to raise money to keep WAMC on the air. I'm Ian Pickus.
I'm Sarah LaDuke, and I get to hang out with all the greats. What's up, babe?
And you're the volunteer.
Woo! Thank you for being here.
We're trying to keep the momentum going. You know, we have $371,000 raised in the lockbox.
People
Incredible.
Kept pledging while we were off the air, because when I left, it was lower than that.
So you guys got it off to a great start.
One hopes.
We've got to keep the momentum going. We're trying to make it to $375,000 in the lockbox by 10 o'clock. And let's zoom out just a couple clicks here. Big picture, we want to keep the station on the air. We want to keep this educational and informative programming on the air. It's an election season. There are hurricanes. It's a hard time in the news. And with your support, we will be able to keep WAMC going and, crucially, have a short fund drive starting next week.
It's very important. We really hope that the fund drive is short for us, but more so for the listenership, so that we can continue to bring important information during this monumental election season. 800-323-9260. We do have a challenge on the table from Steve and Jeannie Gottlieb.
I know them.
Steven and Jeanette Gottlieb of Albany, New York. If we can reach $375,000 in the lockbox by 10 a.m., which is a little under half an hour from now, they will give us an additional $1,000. And wouldn't that be marvelous?
It would be wonderful, and it would help keep the momentum going. That's the whole idea of the lockbox. It's the whole idea of the fund drive. Let's keep WAMC where it is. So many people use the station, and they use it in a variety of ways. Maybe it's while you're driving into work in the morning on the commute. Maybe it's a download. Maybe it's on the website. And you and I both know, on those rare occasions when something has gone wrong and the thing is not where it's supposed to be at the time when it is supposed to be, we hear from you.
We
do. So we know you count on it, and now is the time to make sure it stays.
1-800-323-9262. We are asking this morning for you to let us know how you've seen climate change, how you've witnessed climate change in your real life, where you live or where you've been, how you've seen it practically affect you or people you know. 800-323-9262. If you'd like to answer that question, you can attach it to your pledge. It's not at all required. If you're like, ooh, I don't have an answer for this, but I really want to give, do give. 800-323-9262. One reply we got to the question this morning: the Hudson River used to ice over regularly, and it doesn't ice over as often these days. Chris,
that's
from
true.
Castleton, let us know.
1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. We heard from Jesse in West Park, New York, a longtime member. I love so many things about the radio station. I depend on the station during this election season. Also from Catskill, Peter, and a different Peter, maybe it's the same one with two addresses, who could say, in Durham, New York. Thank you so much.
1-800-323-9262. Again, let me tell you, there's a challenge on the table. If we can reach $375,000 in the lockbox by 10 a.m., which is less than half an hour from now, 1-800-323-9262. And to do that, we need $3,727. $3,727 stand between us and being able to accept the generous challenge funds from the Gottliebs. Please
who
let us.
Always there for us.
So, in so many ways. 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. An incredible program on the roundtable this morning. As producer, I am not humble enough to not say that I think it's a good program.
And you guys pulled it together.
We did indeed. Thank you to the connections that Jeff Goodell has to the region and the station, and an affinity for, of course, our fantastic host, Joe Donahue.
And we hear so much about the importance of covering the climate and climate change. We know it's something listeners are very interested in, and there's so much programming on this station devoted to the climate and the environment and the changing climate and environment. So keep us on the beat.
Thank you to James in Kingston, New York, who is a sustaining member, grateful for WAMC and all who work there. We also heard from Marjorie, who is a new member and sustaining
member.
Wow,
did you hit both with one hand?
I did a little rock and
that was impressive.
A little rock. Thanks. The bell was underserved, but I'll practice. Marjorie says, climate change is about our children and grandchildren, the next generation. Hear, hear. Thank you to Anonymous in West Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Obviously, the hottest summer that I've experienced here. Thank you to
and
Karen.
And the braddest.
The braddest of summers. Thank you to Karen of Williamstown, Massachusetts, who says, I love the morning program with Joe Donahue. And thank you to Scott and Bernice in Williamstown, Massachusetts, with my sister in Florida in the eye of the hurricane. Ooh. I had to donate, but I appreciate the station.
Stay safe, folks. And please. Get out if you can. I know some people who hightailed it to Alabama.
1-800-323-9262. Very scary to by necessity leave your home behind and not know what will happen to it while you're gone. Let us now return to the roundtable panel, but you can keep pledging 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
Thank you very much. Keep going. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. We have an interesting discussion going on with a incredible panel this morning. Jeff Goodell joins us. He is the author of the book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet, and has covered climate change for more than two decades at Rolling Stone and the New York Times Magazine, among others. We also welcome Bob Griffin, Anna Markowitz, and Mark Whitman. I don't know why I think when I say Bob Griffin, I've already said Mark Whitman. I guess I know why I do that, but still, I should get over it. Welcome back.
I am Mark Stunt Double, so I can understand why you're...
It's very good.
Just so listeners know, no one's sitting in anyone's lap. We all have our own chairs.
No, you all have our own chairs. We're all you know, at the moment, anyway, safe. Jeff, let me ask you a question about some of the things that we were talking about before the break. And, you know, you think about these communities and you think about living along the coast of Florida, you think about living along the coast of North Carolina or South Carolina, and the inherent dangers. But what is it that then makes Asheville, North Carolina, such a spot that is the focal point of the devastation of that storm, which sort of would indicate to me that really no place is ultimately safe?
Well, I think that's very true. No place is ultimately safe. There is this notion that, you know, there's a safe haven that you can, you know, find a bubble to live in and where you will be safe from all these things we're talking about. And I, you know, I was just in Asheville 3 months ago driving around here with my wife. I live in Texas now, sadly left Saratoga Springs and live in the belly of the climate beast in Texas. And we were fleeing the extreme heat, and it was so hot in Austin that we said we had to get out of here. And so we decided to go to Asheville. And we were driving around, and I was saying, well, this would be a great place to be in the you know, superheated climate world. It's like got elevation, it's relatively cool, there's no oceans nearby, you know, to worry about sea level rise. It's a, you know, a thriving economy. It's like some parts of upstate New York. It would seem like a very safe place. And yet, look what happened here, you know? And it really does underscore these risks that our entire kind of built infrastructure is much more fragile than we understand it to be. But before we go on, I want to just interject one other aspect of this, especially with the hurricane that's barreling into Florida right now. When we think about adapting and what we're going to do and how we're going to build or not build in these places, I have to remember, this is a monstrous storm that is coming into a state that is governed by a governor who has decided to ban the phrases climate change from any state documents or laws. You're not allowed to talk about climate change, basically, in Florida. And the state is, you know, by all, you know, indications, going to vote for a man who thinks that climate change is a hoax. I mean, so when we think about, like, adapting and we think about how we're going to deal with this in the big picture, the kind of political and culture war aspects of this are an enormous issue. It is just how do you think about changing, you know, where we build and building codes and all the complexities of flood insurance and all that when you have a governor who won't even say the phrase and you have people voting for a president who thinks it's all a hoax. And the first thing he wants to do when he gets in the office, he has said, is drill, baby, drill.
It is, go ahead, Mark.
Jeff, this is Mark, and being a banker, I have an answer. Unfortunately, it's a terrible answer, which is the markets will catch up with Florida eventually if they keep trying to live in Disney World. You know, they're already facing a tremendous fiscal crisis with respect to the insurance that the state offers, and it's going to become untenable for the state to support people in the geographies where they currently reside with proper insurance. The bad news is you don't want to get to that situation in a society where the market's making the corrections, because those that suffer the most are those with the least means and the most vulnerable. So the good news is there is a backstop to all this, just like, frankly, there is to the national debt. But the bad news is if you let it get that bad before you start making policy corrections, you're harming a disadvantage. You're disproportionately harming a disadvantaged group.
Well, and DeSantis has been playing this game of Russian roulette. I mean, maybe it's political Darwinism. I hate to say that, but in some respects, the government you get is the government you vote for, and people need to understand that there's consequences of who you elect. And I think we unfortunately could see this occurring in Florida. And Jeff, one of the things that I thought you were going to go to is they still haven't cleaned up from the last storm, or actually the last two storms, because the ground was already saturated before Helene came in. There are just mountains of piles of debris that are sitting in the communities that are now in the path of Milton. And Joe, these are all, in addition to a 10 to 15 foot surge, this is all going to get picked up by 100 to 130 to 150 mile an hour wind, which is these things. I've actually seen 2x4s taken and embedded into concrete walls by right. The force of the wind. All of this is just ammunition sitting there. So I think the damage that we could potentially see from Milton is above and beyond what we've seen. It's certainly it's going to be fundamentally different than Katrina, because Katrina, if you think about the damage in New Orleans, wasn't necessarily because of the wind. It was from the levees breaking.
Right.
If you want to think about catastrophic damage from Katrina, you actually need to look at places like Biloxi. I think there's a unfortunately day of reckoning, and I certainly pray and hope that the people are safe in Florida, but I think the government has done them a disservice there.
One of the things that we're hearing at this moment, right now, is about the window to evacuate is closing, and to getting out is no longer going to be a possibility. And I guess this is on the tail of what Jeff, what you were saying about people who are going to vote for DeSantis, are going to vote for Trump, but also people who look at this storm that's barreling in to the Gulf Coast and saying, yeah, I don't, it's all a hoax, I'm just going to stay put. Mm-hmm. I live in Greenwich, New York, and I'm ready to evacuate. I don't understand. I don't get that. I don't understand that at all, of how you can. And I guess I've heard it explained that the media hypes these storms and that people that they evacuate and then nothing happens, and I guess I get that to some extent. But man, it's hard to look at this storm on a map and look at radar and not think that you're going to somehow be affected by it.
Well, so I've done one storm visit with Sandy for President Obama, and it was right after the devastation hit on Staten Island. And after a lot of these visits, they meet with people who have lost loved ones in the storm. And so it was my job to greet a family who the husband was a first responder, and so he couldn't evacuate. And so the kids and the wife were in a house hoping that it would be okay. And the waters hit the house. And so they decided to get into the car and try to drive away. And they didn't make it. The mom got out of the car and the two kids washed away and they never saw them again. And so maybe it's just having viscerally looked at that mom in the eyes and seen the loss that she will forever feel. but like I'm evacuating. Like, that is, you don't mess around with
right.
storms. Like, people lose loved ones and there's no coming back from that. Is it worth like risking your life to sit in your house during a storm? I don't know.
But this is where we run into, so there's a whole other set of issues here. Like, you know, I read an article about a mother of six who just doesn't have the money.
Right.
Okay, so how is government, how do we weave a safety net so that it's not a socioeconomic question, it's a safety issue? And not only that, but then you start to ask the question of, why can't we be more flexible with things like SNAP and our food benefits to make sure that there is, you can actually live. And the fact that the speaker refuses to bring the House back because he says, well, in 30 days, we'll be back in 30 days, we'll take care of it then, is such a slap in the face of people who want to know that the government is standing by, ready to help as much as it can. I think really plays into this, but there's a whole lot of other policies that are being put in place here that are showing our failures as a society.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll be back with this subject. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We toss it over to Pledge Central.
Hello there. I'm Sarah Ledoux.
I'm Ian Pickus.
And the phone number is 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262. We are here to remind you that programs like the one you're listening to now are made possible by the support of listeners.
They don't just happen.
You. They do not just happen. We need funds to be a radio station, and that's why we come to our listeners and say, with all respect, appreciation,
no
and affection,
disrespect.
Give us your money. 1-800-323-9262. Whatever you can afford, please support the station. 800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262.
And here's the situation. We are running out of time, and we have a challenge on the table from our friend Steve and Jeanette Gottlieb. You know Steve Gottlieb from his weekly commentaries on Northeast Report going back a few decades at this point. They've been with us every step of the way, and they have $1,000 on the table right now. If we can make the lockbox get to the $375,000 point, this will put us in great shape for today. It'll put us in great shape for the October Fund Drive. Folks, we want to keep our regular programming on the air. And this is your time to shine. You can help us shorten the on-air drive. And you can help us get back to the scintillating discussions that you're used to on WAMC. Right now, we're talking about the existential issue of our time, climate change and its effects on humanity. Please help us keep this program where it is.
And I know you're afraid of animals because they're unpredictable.
That's true.
You respect them.
I respect them, and I treat them well. But I,
yeah,
you know, and this is part of climate change. They don't have as much, their natural habitat is going away because of our impacts, and they're going to be more likely to be interacting with humans.
1-800-323-9262. We would love to achieve the challenge that the Gottliebs have thrown down for us to reach $375,000 in the lockbox by 10 a.m.,
12 minutes away,
which is just under 12 minutes from now, and we need to raise $2,557 in the next 12 minutes to make the challenge. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Please do what you can, whatever you can, any amount that you can afford. We like to emphasize periodically throughout the drive that we're not asking you to blow out your household budget, your personal budget, just if you have some discretionary funds or things you have earmarked for charitable donations, and you can listen to listen to WAMC, and you could call or go online and support the station. We can't say thank you enough, but we will continue to say thank you over and over and over forever, as long as we're on the air.
That's true. And we've all at this table, we've seen a $5 pledge, we've seen a $50 pledge, and sometimes we've seen a $5,000 pledge. Any piece of that you can do, it just helps. We're trying to keep the momentum going, keep the phones ringing, keep WAMC.org where it is, and you can do your part. It's the lockbox. We're trying to shorten the on-air drive, which is supposed to start Monday. It's the middle of October. We're so close to the election. There's so many things going on. The news cycle right now is unrelenting,
yeah.
And we don't want to take time away from what we can offer with perspective and information. That's all this is.
There's no indication that the news cycle will become relenting.
That's true.
1-800-323-9262. So to continue coverage, please support the station. Help us make this challenge. We would love to come back at the top of the hour and see that we have succeeded in this. Obviously, we would love to succeed. I don't know who loves to fail. I know you can learn a lot from that, but one prefers success. 800-323-9262. $2,393 between us and the challenge. It is time to return to the panel, but please keep pledging. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Take it away, Joe.
Thank you very much, Sarah LaDuke. Thanks to Ian Pickus, and thanks to all of you who are helping out this morning. We are talking about the storms. We're talking about Hurricane Milton, of course, Hurricane Helene, and still dealing with the aftermath of that storm. Jeff Goodell is our guest, joining us from Asheville, North Carolina, on the ground there, reporting from that state and that locality of where there was such devastation. Anna Markowitz, Bob Griffin, Mark Whitman, all with us this morning. We welcome your letters. We have quite a few. We'll get to those probably after the top of the hour. So I guess, Jeff, I think as you go into an area like this, you go into Asheville, and as you said, you're reporting on this. What are some of the questions that you've posed to yourself that you want to explore and look at?
Well, you know, for this, I'm really starting thinking about my next book, and my next book is really going to be about kind of accountability for these kinds of events and what the sort of rebuilding process looks like. And so I'm here talking to people about what they lost, how they're going to begin rebuilding, you know, what FEMA is doing for them, what the local governments are doing for them. Are they going to rebuild in the same place? Are they thinking about moving? Are they going to change how they think about their lives now because of what's happened here? So I'm trying to see to what degree this is a kind of transformational event for the people that I've met here, and to what degree it's just going to be kind of rebuilding in the same old way and kind of repeating the same process. But, you know, one thing I want to bring up that I think is really important that I've experienced here already and goes to the conversation that we've been having, which is this assumption of kind of good government, like what can government do and how can government help and what can FEMA do and everything like that. And one of the things that is so striking about what I'm seeing here in Asheville is this whole crazy disinformation stuff about like FEMA being the bad guy, right? That FEMA, that President Biden has taken funds out of FEMA to give to immigrants, and that you know they're FEMA is enabling people to steal land for lithium mines. It's just like crazy, and this has not been my experience in other hurricanes. And I think that one of the things that we're seeing, because this is an election, and we're in this moment where we have, you know, Donald Trump running this kind of dystopic campaign, you know, he's embracing the chaos. In a certain way, for him, I think these hurricanes are a good thing because they enable him to stow chaos, bring up questions about governance, bring up questions about FEMA. I mean, we have to remember they tried to cut the budget of FEMA right before these hurricanes hit. Yeah. You know, Donald Trump in the Project 2025 wants to eliminate NOAA, the, you know, national, you know, climate and weather science body that is the one that warns us about these hurricanes. And so it's a really dystopian political feeling that I'm getting on the ground here in North Carolina.
Two quick questions that I have for you before I go over to Bob, because I want to talk a little bit more about FEMA. But one is, we've all heard the stories over the last 48, 72 hours about the, well, really since this, the Helene hit, but the misinformation that is happening and the misinformation that is coming from the Trump campaign. And I don't know how we even process that as to have it not be just loathsome. And so that's you can make that into a question if you want. It's sort of a do-it-yourself kit, Jeff. You can make that into a question. The other thing is, and then you have, of course, Vice President Harris, and I'm curious as to what you make of the way that she is handling the current situation on the ground.
Well, I mean, I think Vice President Harris is doing what she can do, which is basically, you know, get out of the way, run a competent, allow FEMA to do its job, support FEMA in every way that they can, you know, do all the kind of good governance things that need to be done in a situation like this, which is get the resources here, make sure the funding is freed up, reassure people that the government is here to help. I mean, I've seen FEMA people all over the place here. There's been there's no lack of sort of government presence here in the best kind of way, so far as I can tell. And I actually think on the ground here, except for a couple of kind of wackos that I've run into, that there's a general appreciation of that. And that I think that the media and people like us who are reading about this from afar have a more contorted picture of what's going on than what's actually on the ground in Asheville. And that is because the Trump campaign and others are really playing this up in national media, and they're really trying to sow doubt about all this. Whereas, in fact, on the ground, you know, people are working their butts off, and there is an amazing sort of sense of community spirit here that is kind of underlaying this sort of larger kind of dystopian idea about all this. And I just think that the, you know, when you have a 48% of the population voting or potentially voting for someone who really embraces climate chaos, I mean, there's sort of no other way to put it. I mean, I think Trump likes this because it gives him opportunities to, you know, play people off each other and to give this sense of only, you know, the tough guy, strong man can save us from this, as if he, like with his felt marker, could change the path of the hurricane, right? I mean, that's the underlying message here, you know? Elect me and I will, like, change hurricanes with my felt marker, and I will fly over Asheville and spread, you know, glitter dust all over you all, and everything will be fine, you know? And it's just, it's just not the way it is.
Bob.
You know, there are a couple things, Joe. I mean, there are multiple different things. The politicalization of an active response is just repugnant to me. It shows another layer of you use the word chaos. I could use bovine excrement coming out of the Trump campaign. But there are some things with FEMA that I think need to be done. One is that I actually think that FEMA needs to be taken out of Department of Homeland Security, and we should stand up a cabinet-level position dealing with disasters and resiliency. How we handle flood insurance, how we handle disasters, how we handle rework of critical infrastructure, and I think there's an opportunity to think differently even about the continued infrastructure bill. As I said earlier, we need to fundamentally rethink some of the core engineering standards behind a lot of infrastructure that people walk by every day and don't recognize, and nobody would recognize it until it doesn't work. There also needs to be, I think, a more common sense approach to critical infrastructure that is owned in the private and by the private sector, which is driven by profit versus by service, and that's going to be a much stickier situation. But when you start to look at sort of critical infrastructures, things like water, things like communications, things like sewerage, things like the electric grid. These are all issues, and you know, during the break, the panel here we're having conversations about the need to continue to expand in alternative ways, or you know, how do we promote things like fusion, or you know, continue to support the move towards green, resilient technologies.
Let's take up that when we return. We welcome you and your letters. We'll get to some of them on the other side of the top of the hour break. We welcome you at panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation first. We will go to a legal ID and then a little journey into Pledge Central, and then we'll be back in just a few right after this.
Everyone, we made the challenge.
Let's go.
1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262. That's Ian Pickus.
That's Sarah LaDuke.
And we are here to remind you of the phone number, the website, and what we're doing.
Right. So the phone number, 800-323-9262, 800-323-WAMC on your touch tone dial.
The website, wamc.org, wamc.org.
Oh, soccer blue. And
what we're doing.
Right. This is the lockbox portion of the October fund drive, and we're trying to raise money so that we can have a short on-air drive starting next week. And in fact, while the panel was talking about some very grim topics, we got some good news in this room.
We did. We made the challenge. Stephen Jean Gottlieb of Albany, New York, said if you can reach $375,000 in the lockbox by 10 a.m., we will give you an additional $1,000. I was sitting in the room watching going, oh, we're going to make it. Are we going to basically make it? It's going to be really close. Mm-hmm. And with 48 seconds to spare, we made the challenge.
We did not want to let down the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Law Professor, and we did not.
And we did
it. We made it.
All right. You want to thank some people?
Yes. Tom and Kathleen checked in from South Deerfield, Mass., and said, the seasons seem to be lasting longer and feel more like a Maryland summer. It doesn't feel right. We're asking people to weigh in with what they've noticed about climate change. We heard from a new member, Amber, of South Glens Falls, New York. Thank you for all the good work you do. Also, Phyllis in Kerhonkson and Kathleen in Schenectady, and sustaining member Anonymous of Ballston Lake, New York. I love the truth. It's a wonderful station.
1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262, or WAMC.org. Thank you to new member Anita in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, the greatest of Barringtons. Thank you to Allison and Kenneth in Pine Plains, New York. Lisa in Tieringham, Mass., who says thank you for all you do. Well, thank you for what you did, Lisa. Thanks to Steve and Laura in Ghent, New York. We love all WAMC programming. We heard from Anonymous in Poughkeepsie, New York, and Jill in Tuxedo Park, New York.
Also, Michael in Albany, who says you keep me knowledgeable about statewide politics. Thank you. It's about that time of year. Also, to Nancy and Duncan from Glenmont, New York, who say, keep up the good work. And Anonymous in Averill Park said, kudos to Steve and Jeanette Gottlieb, who made the challenge for us. So thank you so much.
Pamela in Troy, New York.
I have to continue the thought. There's a second page.
Okay.
In addition to saying thank you, we've lost a lot of trees on our property due to climate changes.
Yes.
My bad, guys.
So you're in big trouble, and we're going to have a meeting.
About
your performance later. And you're going to hear from me. 1-800-323-9262. Thanks to Pamela in Troy, New York, who says, how has climate change affected the area I live in? How long have you got? In the seven decades I have lived in the Hudson Valley, I have seen typical summer daytime temperatures go up 10 degrees. Winter lows are 20 degrees warmer. I've owned my home for 32 years, and for the first 20, air conditioning was not essential. I cannot live here as a retired person without air conditioning because the overnight lows are no longer below 70 degrees, and it's impossible to cool the house enough overnight to sleep or reduce the inside temperature enough to get through the next day. Storms are stronger and more destructive. Areas which seldom saw extreme weather are being flooded by hurricanes. Tornado watches have become common in areas which almost never had them. That was extremely true this summer. Plants bloom earlier, but that's not always a good thing, and flood maps are no longer accurate. 100-year storms have become annual. An incredible summary from a listener observing much of what we hear about in the roundtable panel conversation today or on the news as we cover climate change.
Do you have one that you've noticed?
We don't get any snow.
Yeah, that's true.
To speak of. And it comes in just big, there used to be smaller accumulations over more days of the winter, mm-hmm. more manageable on one's shoveling back. But now you get dumped a few times and that feels like it.
You know what was weird for me, and this is obviously like a very anodyne example, but trying to catch a fly ball while the sky is orange from wildfires from 3,500 miles away.
It's very strange.
It's eerie. I
didn't mean to immediately scoff, but I'm, again, it's a Pavlovian response to hearing about fly balls.
That is entirely fair. Hey, Vincent in Albany, New York says, love Steve and Jeanette and WAMC. Thank you. Anonymous in Saratoga Springs, New York. Hometown. Tula in Albany says, We are so late in finally talking seriously about climate change, and many still do not believe in it as if it were a matter of belief. People are moving to Florida. Buildings continue to rise on the coast. Everybody's home insurance is rising in the north, covering the cost of irresponsible individuals and builders. We all need to take a responsibility for our own actions. Drive less. Don't idle your car. Use public transportation if available. Keep your thermostats lower in the winter, higher in the summer. You don't always have to be so comfortable. Sign up for solar fields, etc. A friend of mine yesterday said, yeah, we're a moccasin and hoodie household. Also, we heard from Dina in Wine and Skill, New York on climate change. Thank you.
800-323-9262. Thanks also to Anonymous in Delmar, New York, from Becky and Ben in honor of Steve and Jean Gottlieb and the principles they have adhered to for years. It is time now to return to the round table. Oh, you want to thank somebody?
Can I get three more in under the wire?
Yes.
Thanks to Andrea from Pine Bush, New York, who loves WAMC, Justin in Averill Park, and Anonymous in South Hadley, Mass. Thank you for reporting everything. I am alone, and WAMC is my source for info and pleasure. I am very thankful. Anonymous, thank you.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Please keep pledging, and we will be back again soon.
Thank you very much to Ian Pickett and Sarah LeDuc and to all of you who are helping out in this. We are knee-deep in a conversation on the storms that are impacting this country right now. Hurricane Milton is expected to hit the state of Florida as a Category 4 hurricane. It was a Category 4 yesterday, then went back up to a Category 5, back to a Category 4, a massive storm. There's that. And we are discussing that, and we're also discussing with Jeff Goodell, who is our special guest this morning, who is on the ground in Asheville, North Carolina, covering the devastation there. And we also have your letters. What I'd like to do in our final break here, we have a few minutes. We have until 10:30. And what I'd like to do is accomplish two things. One is I'd like to talk about the political ramifications of all of this. And I'd also like then to get to some letters. Jeff, when you look about the impact that this is going to have on the election, I mean, we have talked about the politics of this to some extent. Does this, in your opinion, impact the election in any major way?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, we will see. And also, I have to apologize for all the sirens in the background. This is what happens when you're doing an interview like this from the middle of a kind of crisis zone like I'm in. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, I don't know that it's going to move the election in the sense of people are going to have this wake-up moment after we see the devastation that is going to we're going to be watching this weekend, and have this aha, oh, climate change is real, it's very scary, it's dangerous, I better vote for Kamala Harris. You know, I don't think many Trumpers are going to have that kind of moment of revelation. But I do think it can impact the election in other ways, which, first of all, I think that just the access to voting, you know, that's a big issue here in North Carolina. I know they're dealing with right now, just getting to the polls and the in the midst of the chaos of the rebuilding and the aftermath of these events, to what extent is that going to suppress the vote, or is that going to get more people out? I think that is, you know, in itself a really big issue. I think this FEMA stuff could the conspiracy stuff around FEMA could also be an issue that motivates voters, especially maybe on the right, to get out more. I think it's impossible to say right now how this is going to play, but it is striking to me that, you know, there's been a lot of writing in the media and talking to the media about how climate change is kind of not part of this election. Well, climate change really is part of this election. I mean, it is, you know, coming down, like, you know, it's as if Mother Nature herself is like saying, hey, pay attention, listen
right.
to me, vote.
Yeah.
You know? So this is, in a way, becoming a climate change election. But how it will play, I think, is just impossible to speculate on.
First of all, we don't mind the fire truck sounds as long as you don't get hit by a fire truck.
Yeah, no, I'm safe.
Okay, good.
I'm safe.
Anna.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the access to voting is going to be very interesting. Asheville is a very blue part of the state, and I do wonder if there's low voter turnout due to, you know, poor access to voting or due to the fact that people have relocated out of that area. You know, how will that impact North Carolina? So I think that that is very interesting. Yeah, I don't know if people would switch to Kamala or switch to Trump. I'm trying to imagine, like, I live in a very blue area of the Catskills that is surrounded by red, kind of similar to North Carolina. And if a devastation event like that happened where we are, I can't imagine us all of a sudden being like, well, I'm mad at FEMA, I'm going to vote for Trump. So I don't think it's going to change the election significantly. I think there would have to be a real misstep on one of the sides to have it impacted at all.
Mark Whitman.
Joe, I don't have a calculator that tells me which way things go as a result of this politically. I do. I'm a little disappointed in the Democrats. They need to get a surrogate out there on behalf of Harris. The only administration that I'm aware of that's diverted funds from FEMA to immigrant detention was the Trump administration. So Trump is once again accusing Biden and the current administration of doing the exact thing that they haven't done that he actually historically has, which is par for the course with him and his projection. So I do think whether or not you think it's going to affect things in the aggregate, you still need to put up your shields if you're the Democrats. And I'm not sure that I've heard that they've done that effectively yet. I understand it's always difficult. I also think they need to anticipate the issues in Florida, and they need to start talking now about the state insurance fund that Governor DeSantis has already set upside down. It's underwater. It's only it's literally and figuratively been underwater, and the water level's rising. So it's only going to get worse in Florida, and I think the Democrats need to start talking about that now, even though there's a risk of sort of politicizing the disaster. It's going to happen to them if they don't do it, so they might as well get out in front of it. But Joe, I you know, I don't think Florida was going to support Harris anyway, and in South Carolina, I think it's really hard because my understanding, and we talked to the I forget the gentleman from the Political Institute who was on with us last week.
Oh, Tim Versalotti.
Yeah, who said that those areas are typically red, but they've got some big blue intense spots in them around educational institutions in South Carolina. So it's hard. The net probably isn't as great as you might have thought it was, given the geography.
Bob Griffin.
You know, I think a lot of it depends on the scope of Milton coming in and the perception for the people on the ground, particularly about progress. Not that everything needs to be fixed in a month, but if the feeling is that things are going artificially slow, then you do stand to have a potential backlash. And again, people are patient, but you know, after you've been without power for 3 weeks, it begins to create a level of discontent that that could potentially impact. But there's a lot of other variables, including, you know, we make an assumption with Milton that that's going to be the last storm. But you look at the situation, the temperature in the Gulf, and there could be more storms. And just because hurricane season ends on, quote, November 1st, Mother Nature doesn't follow the Gregorian calendar, okay? I mean, the waters are still warm enough where we could see substantive hurricanes well into November.
Yeah, there's no switch to turn.
There
that
is no
off.
Switch, right? Right. It's not like, oh, well, you know, November 1st. Let's move on to fire season. No, you can't do that.
All right. In our final moments, we have about 15 minutes left. I would like to get to as many letters as we can, so we'll roll through these and we'll direct them if anybody has wants to address them. Please, just let me know. Ken writes: are there role model governments outside the U.S. when it comes to the climate crisis? If so, what are those governments doing that the U.S. is not? Jeff, any thoughts on that?
Well, there's certainly our governments are doing better and worse. I think that in my book, I write a lot about France and especially about Paris. Paris is doing an amazing, I think we all saw it during the Olympics, but they've done an amazing job of kind of reinventing this iconic city for the 21st century, you know, doing everything from, you know, greening the inner city to restricting, vehicles in the inner part of the city, cleaning up the Seine so that it's swimmable, re-insulating and repurposing old buildings. They really are led by a very sort of far-sighted mayor who is really understands the challenges that we face living in this superheated climate. And I think, to me, they're the sort of embodiment of this idea of how are we going to live in this new world. So I would point to them.
Nuclear power, writes Ruth, is touted as clean energy. It may be true in some respects, though I am skeptical, but does it make any difference to global warming and climate change?
Ruth, I appreciate your skepticism, but I'd suggest you look at publications like The Economist, for instance. If you look at what happened with Fukushima, it was a horrible disaster, but there's a reasonable argument to be made that there were more deaths in Japan as a result of the rise in electricity prices after Fukushima than there were because of it. The other thing is, you know, storing spent fuels is a horrible conundrum, but it is not like storing zombies. It does not raise from the grave and chase us around. I think there is no reasonable way to get to even approximations of the climate targets that we need to set without a significant increase in the use of nuclear power. And again, if you say, well, I'd like to use something else, the answer for the stability of the grid for the meantime is going to be fossil fuels. And the bad news is we breathe that stuff in and it does affect our mortality.
Anyone else want to address that? Okay. Go to Zachary. I was 15 when Katrina, Rita, and Wilma hit the U.S. I was living in Key West. This year is shaping up to be very similar. We need to start thinking long-term about our infrastructure and the displacement of people around the country. P.S. Jeff, your last book was a huge eye-opener for me, especially about heat domes. That book, of course, being The Heat Will Kill You First. Which is, quite frankly, a scary book. we go to, Russell Miller just wants to say hi, Jeff. He said, my old friend and Rolling Stone colleague, long time no see, Jeff. Great to hear you on the radio. That's from Russell Miller.
Russell says you owe him $5, too.
We don't know. Sam wants to know from you, Bob, does it have to be tuna?
No, it's a chicken. It can be plant based. It just have canned goods and water.
Have food.
Yeah, have food.
All right. ask the panel to discuss immediate remedies for future flooding inhabited environments here in the U.S. and foreign countries. Establishing set routes and areas to flee to ahead of time, with buildings empty and set aside for thousands fleeing from designated areas or camper grounds. Or tenting areas, also major roadways immediately converging to one-way status along with feeder roads. Seems we ought to concentrate on evacuation protocols as soon as possible, since these weather catastrophes are surely coming more and more frequently. Jeff, I'll let you take a whack at that if you would.
Sure. I mean, there's lots of things that we can do to get better prepared for these kinds of disasters. Better prepare cities to be able to, for example, one example is, cities like Copenhagen and other European cities that I've visited have things called sponge parks that, they're designed, they're these sort of places that are designed to absorb the water as it comes in and then let it drain away more slowly. That kind of thing works really well for, major rainfall events and things like that. But the problem is when you have a 15-foot storm surge hitting a giant metropolitan area like Tampa, it is really difficult to think about how to evacuate this in a non-chaotic way. There are certainly better and worse ways of doing it. But, you know, one of the kind of ironic things is that of all the kind of climate impacts that we have, our kind of disaster and evacuation protocols with hurricanes, I think, are the most advanced. I mean, compare that to, you know, heat waves, which I wrote about. You know, there's virtually nothing. You know, maybe you get a beep on your cell phone that it's going to be hot for the next few days, but there's no sense of what to do, how to prepare, what's dangerous, what's not. Hurricanes, you know, if you're paying attention, and anyone who lives in these areas, they know kind of, you know, what to do. And one of the issues they're having right now is just reading about it this morning, is just getting people out who don't want to go. And what does that mean? And the mayor of Tampa said, if you stay, you will die. And that brings up a lot of questions about, you know, government roles and personal freedoms and all that kind of thing.
Well, and this is the paradox of response too, right? I mean, the government can't afford to have huge buildings sitting empty in case there's a catastrophic situation. So what do they do is that you use other municipal buildings, so typically schools. But what happens in a situation like we're seeing with Milton, where you're evacuating literally millions of people, you're gonna put them into schools in South Carolina, but then what happens to the kids that are in those schools? So you start to see the dilemma of how do you deal with mass displacement, which points to me to that we need a very different paradigm as far as our emergency disaster capability, and it can't just be in the hands of the military. We really need to rethink what FEMA and the disaster corps and what the state responsibilities are.
I also just want to mention, if you think about the problem globally, there's actually lots of opportunity for good return on investments in better warning systems in less developed countries and in basic provision of protection as well. So I agree with Jeff. In the United States, you know, we get it mostly right, but I still think there's some room in the United States, but there's lots of room in less well-off countries to give them a hand with protecting people against events like this.
And one canary in the coal mine that I'm watching is once DeSantis really starts to complain about FEMA in the federal government, it's because he's starting to get heat because he didn't do what he should have done. So once you start to see the complaints coming from the governor and the governor's folks, that's going to be deflection for the fact that the leadership in Florida has fundamentally failed.
Anna writes, please address the fact that our food system from the growing to the distribution is being affected worldwide. This, in addition to all the other effects, will and is increase massive migrations. The other issue is what will happen to our essential natural systems worldwide. Insect apocalypse, habitat and biodiversity loss. These are the essential building blocks of the existence of life on Earth as we know it. And it's far more basic than building codes and FEMA. How do we get people to recognize this? Well, hopefully we can walk and chew gum at the same time, right?
Maybe it's because I worked for the agriculture chair, Michelle Henschy. But the agriculture issue is hugely important. I mean, we have California that is drying up as we speak. We have, you know, Florida that's going to be underwater. And I think a lot of people will be looking to the Northeast to grow more food. But yeah, hopefully we can chew gum and walk at the same time because we got a lot to figure out.
I mean, that's right, Jeff, right? I mean, that's been a part of this for as long as you've been writing about it, is that it's not just one issue. It's all of this stuff that we have to address, and we have to address it simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the hardest things to grasp about the climate challenge is exactly what you're talking about, is these kind of cascading consequences. You know, the listener who wrote in talked about crop failure, which is certainly a major issue. In my book, I write about this idea of a Goldilocks zone, that all living things have a Goldilocks zone, this sort of range of temperatures that they thrive in, including us humans. And when they go out of that Goldilocks zone, they either have to adapt, migrate, or die. And that's true with food crops also. But as the listener pointed out, so you have, you know, problems of crop failure in various parts of the world as temperatures rise and as precipitation changes
precipitation changes, and then that changes migration, and we have people starting to move out of these places. And like, what is the single one driving political issue in this election? What is the thing that is going to decide who's going to be our next president? It is this idea of coming across the border, of migration. And you could absolutely argue that this is a climate issue. And so it's these sort of knock-on effects, that this kind of cascading effects, the 20-foot storm or the 15-foot storm surge we're going to see tomorrow and the rest of this week and the consequences of that in Tampa is very dramatic. We all see it on TV and everything. But it's these cascading consequences and making the connection between the sort of migration freakout that we're having in America during this election and the warming temperatures is like one of the central challenges of coming to grips with what we face with the climate crisis.
Mark?
I'm a little bit uneasy with that. I think the immigration freakout we have is primarily the white Christian nationalism that Trump has ended up on somewhat accidentally. It's not the case, as Trump claims, that immigrants have caused the problems with the response in the area that you're in. That's about the diversion that we talked about before. I do think the good news is globally, the easy money on reorienting crops, reorienting farming practices, and thinking about inoculation against the diseases that'll be in different places. You got to spend, but those are easy return dollars to get. The unfortunate thing is, out of the 800, I think it's 30 million people that are food insecure around the world, about 60% of them live in countries that are racked by conflict. Now, you can claim rightfully that environmental factors feed into some of those conflicts, but I do think you have to be careful about the fact that you get a confluence of events that causes these immigration movements that we've seen, and these sort of governmentless states is a big cause for what we're seeing in immigration around the world, and it exacerbates agricultural issues. But the good news is spending against agricultural practices around the world and against diseases are actually pretty high return dollars in terms of ameliorating some of the short, intermediate, and long-term effects of climate change.
We are just about out of time. I want to thank everyone for being with us this morning, and especially thank Jeff for taking time out of his reporting schedule and to be with us for this time. And on the road, Jeff Goodell's latest book is The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. The book is now out in paperback. Jeff, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. Stay safe, and I look forward to our future conversations.
Thank you very much, Joe. And I just want to just say bluntly right now how great you are at your job, and how I think all of my years listening to you, I have tremendous respect for what you do. So when you call me in the middle of nowhere and say, can you come on the air tomorrow? I'm always going to say yes.
Well, I appreciate that greatly. Thank you very much, Jeff. Be well, my friend. Thank you. My thanks also to our incredible panel, Bob Griffin. Bob, thank you very much for being with us, as always, and keeping your eye on this issue.
Thanks, Joe. I think you're wonderful, too.
Thank you very much. Reminding us about tuna and chicken and the like, I appreciate it. Anna Markowitz. Anna, thank you very much. Always good to have you. You're getting ready for, like, just a nut season, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I just came back from San Francisco organizing a huge fundraiser that raised $27 million, which is crazy.
Could you help us out?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So the lockbox, this should be no big deal, guys. No big deal.
And Mark Whitman, thank you very much, Mark. I always appreciate your input. Thank you. We are going to send it over to Pledge Central right now.